Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today, we welcome public speaker, writer, and consultant, Kara Dansky. Kara is also an attorney with a JD from the University of Pennsylvania Law School and a BA from Johns Hopkins University. Kara has an extensive background in criminal justice law and policy. Kara is unabashedly committed to protecting the rights, privacy, and safety of women and girls on the basis of sex in law and throughout society. Kara currently serves on the steering committee of the U.S. chapter of the Women's Human Rights Campaign, which seeks to promote the Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights, and also serves as the chair of the Committee on Law and Legislation for Women's Human Rights Campaign globally. Kara served on the board of the Women's Liberation Front from 2016 to 2020, and most recently, Kara has a new book out titled The Abolition of Sex, How the Transgender Agenda Harms Women and Girls. Kara, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. So you are quite accomplished and extremely motivated, specifically in the arena of helping women and girls. So why? What drives you? And what was the beginning of this passion?
Thanks for asking. I spent about 20 years doing criminal justice reform. I was a public defender. I worked at the ACLU. I worked at Stanford Law School. And all of that was in the interest of really working on the American criminal justice system, which, as many of us know, has a lot of problems. And in 2014, I was talking with a friend, and we were talking about a lot of different things. And I had not really thought too much about so-called gender identity or transgender until then. I just, as some of you know, people may know, I'm generally on the left of the political aisle. And even though I hadn't thought too much about it, I just kind of assumed that that the left's narrative around transgender rights was legitimate, that it was a legitimate movement to protect the civil rights of a marginalized group of people. I just made that assumption without thinking too hard about it. And I was talking with this friend and I mentioned it and she stopped me and she said, no, everything about the so-called transgender movement is anti-woman and anti-feminist. And I was fascinated by that. And I asked her to elaborate and she did. And I got it quite quickly that the argument that some men can choose to identify as women really undermines feminists' ability to be able to fight for the rights, privacy, and safety of women and girls, also known as human females. So that was an insight that I had not had previously. She helped me understand that in 2014. In 2015, I found the organization Women's Liberation Front and joined it. And as you noted, I went on the board in 2016. And as this issue kind of heated up in the media and in policy and in law, Women's Liberation Front got more and more active. And several of us on the board participated in writing several amicus briefs, myself included, that were filed at different levels of federal court. They were filed in the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court. We filed a couple in the Supreme Court. And Women's Liberation Front, I no longer serve on the board, but I'm still a member. It started to get fairly well known as really holding a feminist opposition to so-called gender identity. And I just want to be very clear here. Most feminists do not consider themselves to be on the political right. I know that I don't. So we kept doing that work. I ended up leaving the board in 2020, and I became familiar with the global organization, the Women's Human Rights Campaign, which works to advance a declaration on women's sex-based rights as women and girls globally throughout international law at the UN level and in different countries, including in the US. And toward the end of 2020, the US chapter really started growing. It started, it was brand new. So there was a lot of work to do in terms of organization and structure and fundraising. And I ended up accepting the position of president of the board earlier this year. And we're really excited. And Yeah, I mean, we are just completely committed to the Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights, which demands that governments not replace the word sex with the phrase gender identity. And I know there's a lot to talk about in terms of what that actually means.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I care so much about this issue.
Yeah, it seems like you, it's like, at least for me too, it's a new movement that kind of came on quickly. And it was like, either get on board or get canceled, or, you know, or speak out against it and try to educate others. But I want to talk to you a little bit more about your work with the Women's Human Rights Campaign. Can you just talk a little bit more about, for listeners who maybe aren't familiar with these types of causes, like what they do? Do you help legally with things? Just give us a little bit more of a snapshot on what exactly it does.
It's interesting because it is an international organization. And so all countries' chapters go about it a little bit differently because we have different government structures and different political alignments and things like that. But here in the US, a lot of what we do is we speak with legislators at the state and local level. So for example, there's a bill currently pending before the US Senate, which is called the Equality Act, that we oppose because even though it sounds good, and of course, everybody's in favor of equality, what it actually does is redefine the word sex to include gender identity throughout US civil rights law. And we can talk a little bit more about why that's bad for women and girls. Various states are doing similar things, specifically in the area of sports. There are states that are moving to protect women's sports for women only, and we get actively involved in a lot of those discussions, and we testify before state legislatures, and we talk to lawmakers. Sometimes we go personally, sometimes we testify virtually like this, sometimes we submit written testimony, and we also have a legal brief that we submitted in a case where 20 states have sued the Biden administration over the Biden administration's insistence on redefining the word sex to include gender identity throughout federal administrative law. That was a lot, but I hope that answers your question.
No, it totally does. And I think that it's something people don't always understand, especially in working with the CBC, that what we do, you know, we hold the voice of so many. And so that was an excellent answer. Thank you for that. So I see, let's jump to your book. Listeners and viewers can find it on Amazon, The Abolition of Sex, How Transgender Agenda Harms Women and Girls. And if you're watching this on YouTube, you're seeing Kara put gender identity in quotes and other things in quotes. So let's jump right to that, because in your book and in several of your writings, you talk about the importance of defining the terms, terms like gender identity, trans people, transgender. And in the book, I appreciated an example you give where you talk to a friend and you challenge her for using these terms without really knowing the definition or understanding the meaning. And you talk about how it's hard, almost impossible to even define these terms, yet we're supposed to just accept them and use them. So talk a little bit more about the terms, you know, and how society is using them without any real clear meaning.
Sure. And let me also just say before I forget, the book is also available on Barnes & Noble. I know a lot of people don't like to order off Amazon.
Yes, thank you.
So I talk a little bit in the book about how the term transgender was invented. And it was, right? So everybody has known for hundreds of thousands of years now that there are female people and there are male people. And there are some people, well, let me just back up and say, female people have XX chromosomes and male people have XY chromosomes. There is a tiny sliver of the population, approximately 0.02% of people who do not have either XX or XY chromosomes. They have some other chromosomal configuration. And those people are often referred to as having disorders or differences of sexual development. That's completely legitimate. It's totally true. They have their own movement to protect their own rights. And they're all either still female or male. Every single one of us, because we're all mammals, we're all either female or male. So in the 1960s and 70s, we started to see the development of postmodernism in academia, out of which developed so-called queer theory. And queer theory, you could say a lot about it, but one of its essences is that biological sex does not exist as a material reality. So I've thought a lot about how that idea that biological sex does not exist got into our society, our laws, our media, our living rooms, our boardrooms, our curriculum in schools. How did that happen? And I think the way that it happened is the invention of the word transgender. Because if a bunch of weird academics sitting in ivory towers had tried to sell Americans on the idea that biological sex doesn't exist, I don't think it would have worked, because we all know how babies are made. Right? I mean, so they had to make up a word. And that word that they made up is transgender. And by making up that word, they were able to sort of sneak it in and persuade Americans that there's some coherent category of people for whom biological sex is irrelevant, but there isn't. But it was so powerful and so effective that the vast majority of us across the political spectrum think that there is some category, some coherent category of people who are called trans people. But if a person wants to call him or herself trans, I guess that's fine. If I want to call myself a unicorn, I can do that. But there's no valid reason to protect that in law or to think that it's a civil rights movement. So they invented the word transgender. The first time I'm aware of its use was in the early 1990s. And the only reason I know that, because I didn't know it then, but the only reason I know it now is I was taking a look at the 1994 edition of Professor Janice Raymond's book, The Transsexual Empire, which was initially published in 1979, when she predicted all of this. And then she republished the book in 1994. And in her introduction, she addresses the emergence of the word transgender.
Wow.
So first they persuaded all of society that this is a meaningful category. And then came the concept of gender identity. I don't know exactly where it came from, but what I do know is that in 2004, there was a law passed in the United Kingdom called the Gender Recognition Act. And my understanding of that is that same-sex marriage was not allowed at the time. And so there were same-sex attracted couples who wanted to get married. And the way they did it was by getting a so-called gender recognition certificate, which is something you can get in the UK. You have to go through a series of hormones and surgeries, and then you get your gender recognition certificate. And then the law can consider you to be a member of the opposite sex, which of course is not true. It's a legal fiction, but that's what they did to get around the fact that same-sex attracted people could not legally get married. Now, of course, same-sex attracted people can legally marry each other in the UK, which raises the question of whether that law is even necessary, but that's a question for British society. But then somehow this whole concept of gender recognition morphed over the Atlantic into gender identity. Part of how it did that was something called the Yogyakarta principles, because it was conceived of by a group of men who met in Yogyakarta, Indonesia, and came up with these principles in 2010, rearticulated in 2016, that basically said to the international law bodies, you have to replace sex with gender identity. And that's kind of how it was able to creep in. There is a definition of gender identity in the Equality Act, but it makes no sense. The state of California protects sex as a category, but it defines sex to include things like gender identity, gender expression, gender appearance, but nobody knows what any of those things actually mean. But it is having a devastating impact on women and girls in California and other places, which we can get into. But that's the deal with the language. These are just made up terms. And most of us think we have to accept them, but we don't. One of the things that I really try to communicate is that it's okay to use accurate language. In fact, it's good to use accurate language. If you're talking about men and boys competing in women's sports, we can just say that. We can say men and boys are competing in women's sports. We don't have to say trans athletes. We can just speak truthfully.
Sure. And we'll get to that because I have a question on that too, about the consequences of speaking truthfully. But before I do, something that I hadn't considered until reading your book was that this new definition of sex to include gender identity would affect medical care for women. For example, I work in labor and delivery, on top of also working for the CBC as a nurse. And I have many women who request female-only providers for whatever reason, whether it be religious or for whatever reason. And in your book, you point out that Biden's executive order in a federal sense could stop women from being able to do that because they can't say, I only want female-only providers. So could you expand on some other ways for our listeners who might not be aware of Biden's executive order and how that's affected our safety as women and our health and safety as women in a society?
Yeah, so a couple things. Biden issued a series of orders. The first one he issued on the first day of taking office. And it's terrible. And it tells federal agencies that they have to come up with ways to redefine sex to include gender identity throughout federal administrative law. And in doing that, the Biden administration completely misrepresented a 2020 decision by the Supreme Court. We could talk about that if you'd like to. We don't have to. Over the course of the next several months, the administration issued a series of memos and orders to sort of implement that. And one of them is a memo from the Department of Health and Human Services, which is the one you're referring to. And it doesn't say that women can't ask for a female provider, but what it essentially says by redefining sex to include gender identity is that a woman could request a female provider and the facility, if it's a hospital or a clinic or whatever it is, if it receives funding, federal funding, it could provide her with a male provider. And if she complained and said, I want a female provider, the facility could say, well, this is a female provider, even though he's male, because federal administrative law has now been redefined, has now redefined sex to include so-called gender identity, meaning that any man can be considered female on the basis of his so-called gender identity. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And so what are some other ways? Because you talk about quite a few in the book about how his administration and this executive order has affected our health and safety. And so what are some other ways? I'm thinking just off my head about safety of women who maybe need to go to a crisis shelter or other examples like that.
So the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which regulates virtually all housing throughout the United States, has redefined sex to include gender identity throughout its regulations. And what that means effectively is that a woman who wants to go to a women-only crisis shelter that's federally funded, a woman who wants to be in a female-only dormitory in a college that's federally funded, can't demand that. She can say, I want a female-only crisis shelter. She can say, I want a female-only dormitory. But if there's a man who claims to identify as female, who also wants to be housed there, there's nothing she can do about it. So that's one other example. I mean, another glaring one is Title IX and the obliteration of women's sports. The Biden administration has essentially declared Title IX dead. For anyone who doesn't know, Title IX was enacted in 1972 to protect women and girls in the educational arena generally, and in sports in particular. The regulations that implemented Title IX specifically state that it is appropriate for Title IX funded organizations to maintain separated sports teams and facilities like locker rooms and changing rooms. Nonetheless, the Biden administration just went right on ahead and redefined sex to include gender identity for Title IX purposes, which we're seeing today. It's really affecting women's sports. It was just recently that a male swimmer at the University of Pennsylvania, which is my alma mater, just crushed the records in women's swimming just because he got to say that he is a woman and he meets the criteria under the NCAA's rules for allowing men to compete as women. So there's not much that those female athletes can do. although people are looking into it. Okay, so shelters, healthcare provision, sports, what else? The FBI is a department within, it's an agency within the Department of Justice. The FBI maintains crime statistics according to sex. It has a way of collecting crime data from local law enforcement agencies, and it analyzes it and displays it. And it has a page where you can see the percentage and the number of crimes committed by males versus the percentage and number of crimes committed by females. As most of us know, the overwhelming majority of violent and sex crimes are committed by males. And that's perfectly apparent when you look at the FBI's page. But if the FBI is required to redefine sex to include gender identity, what will come of our society's ability to analyze crime by sex? Will we be able to talk about male violence against women if sex doesn't exist?
And those statistics are kind of staggering. I didn't realize 98% of all rapes were done by males. So I suspect those statistics will change if we proceed forward in this. So let's back up a little bit and talk about how you stated, we just mentioned, that it's okay to talk and use true language and to talk about the truth. But people, as you state in your book, are being fired from their jobs, ejected from organizations, banned from social media for refusing to believe or go along with the lie that you can be a woman just by identifying as such. And I think you are also kind of put on a Twitter timeout, so to speak, for doing so too. So how is this legally okay? And I don't understand how these basic liberties can be taken away. I don't understand legally how this is okay. I'm not a lawyer. So can you enlighten me and our listeners? How are they able to do this?
I mean, part of the reason that most people can be fired is that we have an employment system that really protects employers' ability to fire people. I'm not an employment lawyer at all, so I'm not an expert in this area. But my understanding is that for the most part, most employees can be let go at will, right? So now that's not true for everyone. So for example, at one point a couple years ago, I worked at a city agency and I took a day off and I went to go speak at a panel where I said the kinds of things that I'm saying here with you today. And that was recorded and ended up on YouTube. And someone, I have no idea who, tweeted it at a member of my city council and said a bunch of things. Why is a TERF working for this particular city agency? Probably a lot of your listeners don't know what the word TERF means. We can talk about that.
Yeah.
he got really mad. This council member got really mad and very much wanted to get me fired. Now, he could not successfully get me fired for speech that I engaged in during non-work hours because as a government employee, I have a First Amendment right to say whatever I want during non-work hours with limitations. But, you know, the speech that I engaged in was protected. So the city agency figured out that they couldn't lawfully fire me. But still, the situation just became really untenable because I had no intention of shutting up about this issue. And I knew it was going to go on. So I voluntarily left. I need to make that clear. I was not fired. I voluntarily left. So, but the answer to how can people get fired generally is that most employment is at will. And so employers can terminate people from their employment. But I think, so that's a really important issue. I think an even sort of deeper issue has more to do with social stigma. So if I were to broach this topic in my very liberal circles, for the most part, I would be socially ostracized. I don't know if that's exactly true, but I haven't really tested it because I spend so much time working on this issue that when I'm hanging out in my socially liberal circles, I just kind of want to hang out and forget about it for a while. But if I tested it, it would be really interesting to see if I would be socially ostracized. I have lost friends over this. I lost one of my best friends of over 30 years over this because she thinks I'm being mean for standing up for, you know, adult human females and children human females. I'm sure I've lost a bunch of Facebook friends over this. I don't know. I don't care really. If I lose Facebook friends over this, that's fine. I'm bummed that I have lost my best friend of over 30 years. But, you know, there are so many of us standing up. There are so many of us standing up for women and girls and for the material reality of biological sex that I've gotten a lot more friends than I've lost. So it's worth it in that sense. But the social stigma factor is really interesting. So people like me don't really much care. We're going to say what we're going to say, and we're not going to stop. But average people who don't pay a lot of attention to this topic, I think, feel a lot of fear to speak out. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason I feel that is that I was once meeting with a group of women. This is the Republican women's group for a fairly major US city. And they knew who I am. They knew I'm a radical feminist Democrat. They invited me to meet them, and I was happy to do it. And one of the women said, "Kara, what are we going to do about the problem of transgender athletes in women's sports?" And I said, "Okay, I have some advocacy ideas. But first, let's step back for a second. When you say transgender athletes, what do you mean? Don't tell me what you think you have to say. Tell me what you mean." And she said, she paused and she said, "I thought we had to say that." And I said, "Do you mean men and boys?" And she said, "I didn't think we were allowed to say that." And I find that so fascinating because I don't blame her, because I understand the social pressure to go along with what is in essence an anti-science, anti-reality, sexist nonsense. So I get where she's coming from. Presumably she's a smart, articulate woman, active in local party politics. And she thought she had to use the language that she doesn't agree with. Mm-hmm. And that's how far we've come. And so the fear of being socially stigmatized, I think, is very real.
For sure. I have a lot of people say, you know, because I'm also in that, you know, I live in California, a very liberal state. And so people who know me sometimes know that I'm work for the CBC and I have kind of controversial opinions about things. And on this topic, I have people say, "Oh, just let people do what they want with their bodies. And why is it any business of other people? They should just be able to do what they want with their bodies." And to some point, I can agree with that, right? But it's the trans movement or this ideology that seems to be more harmful than just letting people do what they want with their bodies. I guess my question is there a difference in those two things? And how can we accept people, but also protect women and girls? And how do you deal with that kind of conversation?
Yeah, I mean, the live and let live argument is a really interesting one. And I get our tendency, first of all, as Americans, and second of all, as liberals, to have a sort of laissez-faire, live and let live attitude. But we don't do that about everything. And, you know, the Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights, for example, takes a strong and firm position against the renting of women's wombs for surrogacy purposes. And we don't, you know, a lot of us don't say live and let live when it comes to that, you know. So if someone, first of all, if a man wants to wear a dress, I don't know that I particularly care. I might think he looks silly, but I'm not going to interfere with his ability to wear a dress. If he wants to have a medically unnecessary cosmetic surgery to remove genitalia, I'm not sure our society should go along with that. Mm. I mean, there are some questions that I think are very legitimate, but I'm not the one to answer them. There are legitimate questions for the psychology field to say, if there are people who can legitimately be helped psychologically by mutilating healthy body parts, you know, we can have that conversation. I'm skeptical that it's true. I think there are better ways of dealing with that. If a person sincerely thinks he or she actually is the opposite sex, I would like to think that our society's approach to that would be to compassionately help people understand that they were born in their body. There's no such thing as being born in the wrong body. But the other thing I think that's really important is that men men's bodies don't change that much, even after they claim to identify as women, whether or not they take hormones and surgery. They really don't. Men are still identifiable as men. And those men do not belong in women's spaces. There's been data showing that men who get the hormones and the surgery go on to commit violent and sex crimes at the exact same rate as men who don't do those things. There's also, this is slightly unrelated to your question, but while it's on my mind, there's also data to show that taking hormones and surgeries does nothing to alleviate dysphoria. It just doesn't work in the vast majority of cases. So why shouldn't we have a live and let live attitude? I mean, it sort of goes to another thing I discussed in my book in chapter 5, which is we have to understand this really isn't an individual rights movement. It's really not. This is not about a small group of marginalized people to be able to live their authentic lives. One might also ask if an authentic life can include a lifetime of opposite sex hormones and medically unnecessary surgeries. I'm not really sure what's authentic about that, but but we also need to understand that this whole thing is coming from a top-down, heavily funded industry. And I'll stop there for now. I'm sure you want to talk about that a little bit.
No, this is perfect. I kind of was trying to frame that question in a way that would lead us here. So thank you. In my work at the CBC, I talk a lot about the fertility industry. And it's something I've kind of defined as this large group of people involved in the marketing and profiting of baby making and selling. And so you talk about it in your book about gender identity industry. And so you've segued beautifully into that. Can you talk to our listeners about who this industry is and why it's important that we identify them? And you've kind of already hit the nail on the head there, that this isn't about some small group of people that needs to be protected, but is instead this larger industry at play. So go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, I love CBC's work talking about the fertility industry. I guess I would say at a general level, they're actually not different. Both industries are designed to capitalize off of body parts. I don't know another way to say it.
I love
it. Both are designed to make money off of human bodies at their root. Mm-hmm. I know less about the industry that you talk about, but the gender identity industry does consist of a very small number of incredibly wealthy men who are funding this. So for example, and I don't know if there is literal overlap between the industries, but I would not even be a little bit surprised if there is.
I would either.
Right? They go hand in hand, and I'm sure they're very happy to support each other. So for example, there's a man named John Stryker. John Stryker, well, before I say who he is, let me just ask a few questions. One question is, who benefits from putting young people on a lifetime course of hormones? Who benefits from that?
I'm going to say the pharmaceutical industry.
And who benefits from engaging in medically unnecessary surgeries?
Surgeons
or medical supply companies.
Sure. Yeah.
So John Stryker is a man who is heir to a medical supply company. He's a billionaire and he will become even wealthier once he inherits this medical supply company. He has given billions of dollars to something called the Arcus Foundation. The Arcus Foundation funds primarily what it calls LGBTQ activism. But since most rights for lesbian, gay, and bisexual people have already been secured, as a practical matter, all of that money goes to the T and the Q. So he's funding a lot of this stuff. And there's another guy named Martine Rothblatt, who is a man who once spent millions of dollars creating a robot replica of his wife and was once on the cover of, I want to say it was New Yorker magazine, being described as the wealthiest female CEO in America. And he also funds a lot of this stuff. He funds, he spent millions of dollars to create a super niche plane, aircraft, for flying organs around the country. Now, when most media talks about this, what they're talking about, they paint it as though it's this humanitarian effort to help people in need of organ transplants. But he is a transhumanist. He literally advocates for all of human society no longer being in our bodies and transcending our bodies and living in some sort of virtual reality. Mm-hmm. So it's actually much more sinister than what it might seem at first blush.
It sounds like a lot of conflict of interest too.
And I also just want to say, I am aware that it's on some level, when I say that he's a transhumanist, I sound a little bit like a conspiracy theorist. I'm totally aware of that. But the problem is that he says these things out in the open. If anyone Googles Martine Rothblatt transhumanism, it's all right there. He says it. So I'm not a conspiracy theorist. He's written a book about it. He wrote a book called From Transgender to Transhuman. And he's written a couple other books as well.
Yeah, he's written several, I think, about this topic.
Jennifer Billick, in her fantastic blog, 11th Hour Blog, talks about this as colonizing our bodies. It's corporate colonization of human bodies. And I think she's totally right. As strange as that might sound, I think she's completely right. And she proves it. I mean, she provides evidence for all of her claims.
Yeah. I think it's interesting you talk about, too, the two industries, fertility industry and the gender identity industry merging. We recently did the documentary about children transitioning. And of course, children who transition, who are put on hormones and undergo surgeries, are then rendered infertile. You know, so then they have to, if they do intend on having a family, they have to consider using the fertility industry to do so. So it is totally the two feeding off of one another. And I think if we did some digging, we'd probably find some more conflict of interest.
I wouldn't be surprised if Jennifer Billick has already done that.
Yeah, she's awesome. And we can include a link to her website with this podcast too, so viewers and listeners can find her. I want to change the subject just a tiny bit. And recently you stood with parents in Luding County, Virginia, who are expressing their opposition to the new policy allowing students to use the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity. And I bring that up because it's occurring right now. And also we're writing an article about it currently as well, because it's not getting any quote unquote good press, in my opinion. So could you tell us what you saw there and talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. It's pronounced Loudon.
Sorry, thank you.
No worries. So I live in DC, and Loudon County is maybe a 45-minute drive from DC. And I'm connected with the woman who lives there with her kids. She pulled her kids out of school because of the school district's new policy of allowing boys into the girls' bathroom. And I went twice. I went in August of this year. When I went in August of this year, the parents were there talking about a variety of issues. Some of them were there talking about the gender identity policy. Some of them were there talking about critical race theory. Some of them were there talking about vaccine mandates and things like that. So they were kind of all over the place in terms of the issues that they were bringing. So I went again in October, and this time the parents made a very specific concerted effort to make it about the gender identity policy and to not talk about the other issues and to make it nonpartisan. And I thought that was really smart of them. They were probably mostly on the right, but I don't know that to be true because they didn't talk about it. They talked about the gender identity policy, and they talked about, by this point, they had learned that a girl had been assaulted in a Loudoun County school and that the school passed the gender identity policy, knowing that this girl had been assaulted by a boy in the girls' bathroom. And they were mad, and they were mad as parents. And they were standing there for school safety, for their kids, and for each other's kids. And I found it to be very powerful. I went there with a bunch of other radical feminists, and I held a sign over my head that said, "This Democrat supports female-only spaces," and I had little arrows pointing down at my head, and it got some media attention because people don't expect that. There were there was a group of Democrats. This is right before the gubernatorial election. So there was a group of Democrats who were there with Terry McAuliffe signs. And I don't really know what they were doing there exactly, but they were there. And I just went up to them and I held my "This Democrat Supports Female Only Spaces" sign. And they mostly ignored me, so that's fine. We get a little bit of media coverage. But then what was so interesting and upsetting, in my view, is that they did that. And these parents are not particularly seasoned grassroots organizers. They're just parents. And they made some very smart decisions to get politics out of it and to stand there as parents who cared about the privacy and safety of their kids, especially their girls. And shortly after that happened, the Republican won the gubernatorial election. And to listen to most media outlets talk about it, you'd think that the reason that the Republican won is because of parental outrage over critical race theory. But that critical race theory is part of it, I'm sure. But the meeting of the parents that happened a couple days before the gubernatorial election was not about that. Mm-hmm. It was about parents standing up for kids, for girls, and against the gender identity policy. And I know that because I was there and I listened to these parents talk and I listened to them talk about the policy. I listened to one woman cry while she talked about her daughter being sexually assaulted in a school. And it was really moving. And so I was really angry at the way the media framed it in the following days.
Yeah, I think part of the answer to all of this is parents. We've had a lot of parent support groups reach us after the creation of our film Transmission, which is free on YouTube for anyone, and other support groups of family members, grandparents, that sort of thing, who are concerned about what their kids are being taught in schools and what they're seeing online and that sort of thing. So I'm hopeful that parents can start having a voice and not being afraid to use it like you saw in Virginia. Do you have hope that policies and laws will change in the right direction?
Lately, I do. I wouldn't have said that 6 months ago, but lately I do. And part of the reason I do is that I hear from Democrats all the time on social media and in my email who are so angry at party leadership for what they're doing on this. And people will tell me, I'm a lifelong Democrat and I think that this stuff is crazy. What on earth is our party leadership and our, you know, actual elected officials doing by enshrining so-called gender identity in the law as a replacement for biological sex? I don't have a great reason. Well, I do have kind of a reason for that, which is outlined in the book, but I'm heartened that Democrats, rank and file Democrats, are starting to speak out. Because let's be real, the political reality is that Democrats are pushing gender identity in the law. Republicans are the only ones holding out. However, I find in working in a cross-partisan way with Republicans, that even Republicans still seem to think, and this was what we talked about at the beginning, still seem to think that transgender people is a coherent category.
Sure.
So it's not working. The conservative strategy of pushing back both is and isn't working in various ways. But if we can get Americans across the political aisle to agree that this is crazy, then we can push back effectively on our elected officials. You know, I don't know if everybody knows this, but, you know, I don't know your party and it doesn't matter. I don't know the party of your elected officials and it doesn't matter. Your elected officials represent you as a constituent, whether you're same party or not. We can all be talking to our elected officials.
Yeah, though that leads me to the next question. What can people do to help join in with you and others to protect the rights and privacy of women and girls? And I think one of those answers is getting a hold of your elected official.
Yeah. So one thing is, please check out the Declaration on Women's Sex-Based Rights. You can find it at womensdeclaration.com. It has over 27,000 signatures from individuals all over the world. I think 300 or 400 organizations from all over the world. So if you can sign it, if you feel like it aligns with your values and you want to sign it, please do. Second, please buy my book, Shameless Promotion. And if you can do more, we have a fundraiser going on. When I say we, I mean the US chapter of the Women's Human Rights Campaign. We have a fundraiser going on to send 535 copies of the book to every single member of Congress, every senator, every representative. Wow. And so if listeners feel motivated to do that, I would appreciate that. You can find us at womensdeclarationusa.com. Beyond that, I really want people to be having more conversations with each other, and I don't care about political party. Have conversations in churches, in post offices, in grocery stores. Ask people if they know what's going on here. Do our neighbors understand what is going on when the government tries to replace sex with so-called gender identity? What are the implications of doing that? I really want people to have those conversations. Most importantly, please do not be afraid to speak out about this, because those of us who are kind of standing out here speaking out about it are happy to do it, and we're happy to keep doing it, but it's getting a little lonely and we'd love to have some more voices. So please, please, please start speaking out about it. Really, at the end of the day, the rights, privacy, and safety of women and girls depends on it, but this should also matter to everyone. What I say in my book is that the abolition of sex harms women and girls in particular, and it does, but it really harms everyone. Our society has not thought through the implications of what we're doing, and we really need to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And like we said, you can find her book on Amazon and on Barnes and Noble's. And I've read your book. I love your book. I think it's it's a smart read, but it's an easy read for anyone who is just maybe just learning about this issue or has just had their eyes open to this issue. It's not hard to follow, but Kara does an excellent job of giving examples, showing the legislation, the laws. It's really, really well done. And it's not even a long read. And it really is a great introduction or even an extension of what you already know. One of the reviewers on Amazon said it's the right book at the right time. And I definitely agree with that. I want to end with a quote from your book that I think is really powerful as our time is coming to an end.
Callie, before you do that, can I say one thing about what people
please,
can do?
Please.
So we are seeing all over the world, but here in particular, employers are starting to do things like have quote unquote diversity and inclusion trainings and require employees to put preferred pronouns in their bios. I don't want to put anyone's livelihood at risk. I don't want anyone to risk their job. I do want people to be asking questions. Why do I have to put preferred pronouns in my bio? Why do I have to attend this diversity and inclusion training? And by the way, by diversity and inclusion, it sounds really good. But what they mean is they're going to make you use preferred pronouns. Like, that's basically what it means. It's indoctrination. And ask questions. Mm-hmm. Now, why is this mandatory? What is this telling me? What is this telling me that I can't get from other sources? How is this relevant to my work? Ask those questions. I don't want anyone to put their livelihood at stake, but I do want people to be asking questions.
And that's important. I know in a previous employer that they were starting to do this as well. And, you know, I often find that you're not the only one sometimes, right? Not the only one who doesn't want to just go along with things. So hopefully you can find yourself in a place of employment where you're not the only one who wants to question and just get answers. That's a great point. And thank you. That's a lot of things that people can do. So I hope, and I'll include all of those links in our email about this podcast on YouTube and where our podcast can be found. So listeners, you can find all of the information that Kara's talked about during this show. So to end, in the book, and I can't remember what page it is, but it just really jumped out at me. You state, quote, "Very few Americans understand that this is happening. One reason is that very few of us pay close attention to federal regulatory policy in general. Another reason, however, is that no one in the government or in the media is being honest with Americans about what these developments mean for women and girls. They have simply told us that gender identity is something that needs to be protected in the law without ever telling us what it means or why it needs to be protected. What it means is the complete obliteration of sex in the law and the," I always say this word wrong, "annihilation of the rights to privacy and safety of women and girls. Americans deserve to be told the truth." So I hope today that we have told the truth and that we have enlightened some Americans and empowered them to do something. I want to thank you, Kara, so much for joining me and taking the time out of your day to be on our show. And listeners, you can follow Kara on Twitter with the handle KDansky. That's KDansky. You can also find out more about her and her work and read some really excellent articles that Kara's written at www.karadansky.com. And lastly, you can find her new book, as we've said, on Amazon and on Barnes and Noble. It's titled The Abolition of Sex, How the Transgender Agenda Harms Women and Girls. Our goal here is, as ever, to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you to think beyond the masses. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.